Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Momentum Morbid, your podcast for conversations on death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to exploring these very themes. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. In today's episode, we're going to meet a fascinating thinker whose work examines historical phenomena that challenge our notions of inner and outer, objective and subjective, and real and not real.
So it was an era that was obsessed with degeneration, with hysteria, with the abnormal, and the decadence latched onto some of those ideas, but instead of being sort of panicked by those ideas, they celebrated those ideas. Their novels are populated by homosexuals and all sorts of what were then labeled perversions, I guess, and a lot of sort of evil, you know, wicked women in particular.
Before we bring in this week's guest, I wanted to ask our listeners if you maybe have come across similarly baffling phenomena. If you have something you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note.
Here is a thought that I find fascinating, and it's been offered by historian of religions Ioan Culianu in his masterpiece Out of This World. And according to Culianu, once the mind frees from the body, the mind becomes a world-building force, spinning entire labyrinths of thought where the boundaries of dream, memory, and reality dissolve. And in Culianu's words, it is ultimately you who write the script for your own death. And it depends entirely on you whether you turn it into an endless horror show, a divine comedy, or nothing at all. And this recognition brings immediate liberation.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Asti Hutzfeldt is an independent scholar, author, and historian. She holds a PhD in French literature from New York University and has written extensively on themes close to my own heart, including medicine, gender, and cultural history. I first learned about Asti in her book Medical Muses, Hysteria in 19th Century Paris, which explores the lives of women diagnosed with the now largely non-extant disease of hysteria, which maybe we'll talk about in a little bit. The book won the Gravito Award and was a Los Angeles Times Book Prize finalist. She is also the editor of The Decadent Reader, Fiction, Fantasy, and Perversion from Fin de Siècle, France, which brings together literature reflecting that era's fascination with decadence, morbidity, and the abject. As I said, I first discovered Asti through her work, first through Medical Muses, and then through her brilliant introductions in her Decadent Reader. And I found them both challenging and really exciting, characterized by this delicate balance between extreme rigor and openness, which is always how I think about her work. Openness to the unknown, to the non-rational, and to the unexplainable. She is also one of my favorite humans, scholars, and thinkers, and I'm very excited to welcome her today. Welcome, Asti.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Me too. And it's wonderful to have a formal conversation because thinking about what I wanted to talk to you about, I realize there's so much about how you came to start doing these things I actually don't know. So as I mentioned, I first learned about your work through your books, where your introductions were just so interesting. And you bring in the surrealists, you bring in science of the time. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit about the book, the themes of the book, and how you came to want to put a book like that together.
I did a PhD in French literature, and I focused on the 19th century. And I wrote my dissertation on an author named Villiers de L'Isle-Adam, not very well known. I chose it because I fell in love with a novel he wrote called The Future Eve. But I also, to be perfectly honest, thought, like, what on earth would I be able to contribute to the scholarship of Proust or Balzac or Flaubert? And he was not, even in France, not a particularly well-known writer. And so this book is about a Thomas Edison who creates the perfect woman. My dissertation focused on the book, but really on sort of medical ideas of women at the time and how he was influenced by that. And of course, the late 19th century was a moment when materialism, or the philosophy positivism, which is basically the philosophy that the world is scientifically knowable, reigned. It had really taken over as the arbiter of truth. It had replaced religion, which I think, and the church, capital C, which had really been the authority on what was true and what wasn't, what was real and what wasn't, what was good, what was evil. And suddenly, after Darwin, science really was replacing religion. And the decadents were responding to their age, and they kind of rejected science and materialism, but they borrowed from those ideas in their work. So it was an era that was obsessed with degeneration, with hysteria, with the abnormal, and the decadents latched onto some of those ideas, but instead of being sort of panicked by those ideas, they celebrated those ideas.
Yeah,
you know, so their novels are populated by homosexuals and all sorts of what were then labeled perversions, I guess, and a lot of sort of evil, you know, wicked women in particular.
Yeah. So this is an era where science has come to replace religion, and we have these new ideas of truth and where it's coming from. And I wonder how you think those ideas were alive at the time you were writing this book, and then also now. Like, what do the decadents have to tell us now? Anything?
Well, the truth is, when I was working on this book was a long time ago. So it was the last turn of the century. And I think there's something about the ends of centuries that often, you know, the metaphor of death and rebirth become very alive. So, and I'd say that at this particular moment in time, even though we're, you know, 25 years into the new, you know, the 21st century, we're living in a moment of sort of rising fascism, where these binaries, people are obsessed with enforcing binaries and rejecting anything that might trouble those binaries. And that was very similar as, you know, in the late 19th century too, there was a lot of panic about gender. Many of the decadents themselves, even in their writing, but also in their personal lives, were cross-dressers. It was illegal at the time to cross-dress. And many of the other decadents, too, you know, played around with a fluidity of gender. And right now, of course, we're living in something very similar, which is that, you know, fascists always want to enforce binaries. And so anything that troubles those binaries is perceived as a threat. So you think even the emphasis on borders, you know, physical or geographical borders, but also very strict male-female binaries. So that's why, you know, the attacks on trans people and feminists and gender fluidity and the emphasis on a strict hierarchy with men, especially white Christian men at the top and women at the bottom, where ideally they are submissive, you know, trad wives who know their place. So I think there's similarities, and obviously there's all sorts of differences, but that strikes me as pretty similar.
Yeah. And hearing some of the words you were saying during that, I was thinking of your own work. Things that challenge binaries, I feel like, have been the focus of both of your books to some degree, The Decadent Reader, and then the next book that you wrote, which is Medical Muses. You know, when I discovered your book, I'd been trying to wrap my head around this very strange phenomenon of the 19th century, which I hope you'll talk a little bit more about, a disease that was widely diagnosed mostly to women that doesn't really exist anymore and that had no biological, nothing traceable to a biological cause. I'd read a number of books about hysteria before I found yours, but none of them were comfortable leaving it as open-ended as you were. And I felt like you had such respect for your research and the material that you weren't trying to shoehorn it into, is it or isn't it? Or was it real, capital R real, or was it not? But you had this very nuanced view of looking at it as a cultural moment, a cultural symptom, but also quite real. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, to those listeners who might not even know what hysteria is. What is hysteria? What was going on in the 19th century with hysteria? And how were you drawn to this subject?
Well, I was initially drawn to the subject because, again, I was in graduate school in Paris, and he's actually mostly known as an art historian, but also cultural historian named Georges Didier Huberman, and he had just published a book called The Invention of Hysteria. So, and it was at that point in my world, in the, you know, academia and French theory, it was a big book. Everyone was talking about it. And I read it, and I just found myself really, I still didn't understand what hysteria was. And when many years later, when I set out to write this book, I really thought that I would answer that question, that by doing all this research and really focusing on actual patients, not literature, but patients and doctors, I would come to grips with it and understand it. And of course, that did not happen. So hysteria very broadly was defined as symptoms, real symptoms, not fake symptoms, which is super important. Wasn't people faking symptoms for attention, but authentic symptoms, mostly neurological, blindness, deafness, paralysis, seizures, all this that did not have an organic source. And the guy, the expert on hysteria, not just in France, but really throughout the Western world, and he became really one of the most important and famous scientists of his day. It was this guy named Jean-Martin Charcot. And he's known as the founder of neurology. And in a way, hysteria had existed, you know, throughout time. It goes back to the ancients when they thought it was a wandering womb, like the uterus would roam about the body, and it would wreak havoc in women, creating all kinds of symptoms. And then it went through all kinds of changes. And before Charcot, it really became the disorder where everything that couldn't be classified elsewhere, symptoms in women that they couldn't figure out what the source was, that might look like epilepsy, but they didn't have epilepsy, or you look like blindness, but there was no damage to the optic nerve, all this kind of thing. Medicine was advanced enough that they were able to do that. It was just sort of passed off as a kind of madness in women, or it became a wastebasket diagnosis where you tossed everything that you couldn't fit anywhere else. And Charcot, to his credit, took it very seriously. And he insisted that it was a neurological disease, just like ALS, which he, by the way, is the first person to describe, and MS. He also was the first to come up with MS. So he took it very seriously, and he was determined to locate its source, but he could not find a lesion anywhere in the brains or spinal cords of his patients. So it remained this sort of inexplicable condition. And, you know, there's a lot of things we can fault him for. He was in many ways a misogynist. He was very authoritarian. And at the same time, he took hysteria very seriously, and he didn't dismiss it as either just malingering or women faking symptoms for attention, which was often what it was, you know, thought of, or as madness. So he gave the disease a certain kind of dignity by paying that much attention to it. The other thing I would say, and I believe very strongly, is that, of course, hysteria does still exist. It's not an official diagnosis, but I think hysteria exists, and as long as humans exist, hysteria will exist, because it's basically the disease of symptoms that you can't find an organic source for. So it's been carved up probably into all separate kind of psychiatric things. But at the time, Freud was one of Charcot's students. He was very influenced by him. He translated all of his work into German. Wow. He named his first son after him. But Charcot did not come up with the theory of the unconscious. That's Freud. So the moment you have an unconscious explanation, it shifts into a kind of psychological disease rather than a neurological disease.
Right. So this is very much this particular conundrum of how people were looking at hysteria at that time is very much a product of this moment right before the idea of the unconscious, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, I think that the unconscious, in a way, I'd say that these hysterics were the collaborators in the coming up with the theory of the unconscious. Even Freud, to his credit, acknowledges that with Anna Oh, when he says that she, you know, she's the person who came up with the term the talking cure.
Wow. I think that's so interesting, the idea of the hysterics as collaborators. And it also makes me think of something you talk about in your book where the surrealists were really inspired by the hysterics. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about just how the surrealists saw them and also others at that time as symbols of other sorts of things going on, you know?
Yeah. One of the women, she's very young, so girls, one of the girls I write about who was hospitalized for hysteria at the time went by the name Augustine, and the surrealists latched onto her as their sort of ideal woman. And of course, for the surrealists, it was all about sort of tapping into the unconscious. So they borrowed not just from hysterics, but also from mediums with automatic writing. Mediums would claim that they were communicating with an outside. The surrealists always looked inside. So it was a way of kind of communicating with the unconscious.
Yeah. And I know the work you're working on now, and we'll talk more about that, also plays with gender. And I'm curious about, you know, it's very tempting to look at hysteria, at least in part, as a unconscious protest against the role of women in society, you know, that these women didn't have other forms of conscious expression necessarily. There weren't many avenues open to that form of expression. And I wonder what you think about the fact that most hysterics were women and how that plays in with the culture at the time.
Well, you know, first of all, the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for uterus. And because Charcot defined it as a neurological disease, he insisted that men could be hysterics. However, because he was director of a women's hospital, probably one of the largest hospitals in Europe, I think, at the time, he had thousands of patients, not all of them hysterics, but so he worked mostly with women. He did see men in his private practice, and he insisted that men could be hysterics as well. However, he still, somehow with the men, it was often an outside accident. There were a lot of train accidents at the time, a lot of fear around trains. And so the men he saw had often suffered a kind of physical traumatic injury.
Oh,
whereas
that's interesting.
For women, it was somehow written into their biology. So there were, he moved a little bit away from the uterus, but he insisted that the ovaries were what he called hysterogenic points, which could, by pressing on them, you know, and he developed this sort of awful looking apparatus, but the women often requested it. So I don't think it was particularly painful, called an ovary compressor, which would kind of push down your ovaries from the outside so that you could avoid having a hysterical attack. So you could both trigger and you could start and stop hysterical attacks by pressing on the ovaries. So all sorts of really strange things. But again, for women, it would still seem to be rooted in their biology. And it was also thought for women, pretty much any moment in a woman's or girl's reproductive cycle could be a potential trigger for hysteria. So the onset of menstruation, virginity, but also sexual activity, pregnancy, a lack of pregnancy, menopause, these were all thought to be triggers for hysteria, whereas men obviously didn't have that.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many directions I kind of want to go from everything you just said, but one of them takes me back to the decadent reader and thinking about, you know, talking about the future Eve and talking about this concept of the woman's body as being somehow imperfect and somehow just by its very nature problematic. And I wonder if you could talk about that and that kind of link between the kind of decadent fear of or concern with the imperfections of the women's body and how we might make that better and how we're seeing that play out in our understandings of the female body at that time through hysteria.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things when I was doing research for the book, I spent time in sort of 19th century medical encyclopedias, and there was this big authoritative medical encyclopedia, and in it there is a entry for woman, which is many pages long. It's one of the longest entries in the entire encyclopedia. And there is not an entry for man because men are somehow the norm against which female abnormality is measured. And I think, you know, that continues. We're so much embedded in our own cultures that we don't always see it. But of course, that does continue in medicine and with somehow the way that the female reproductive cycle is medicalized somehow needs medical intervention, whether it's giving birth or every moment of the female reproductive cycle has a sort of medical specialty attached to it in a way that men somehow are, who also, by the way, have reproductive cycles and hormone shifts and all these kind of things, but somehow it's still discussed as a sort of as a female thing. And I think for the decadents had a kind of twofold attitude towards women. They were detested because they were somehow constructed or thought of as closer to nature, and the decadents had a horror of nature. But they were also revered because they were somehow closer to artifice. So the sort of bejeweled, the gowns and the jewels and the makeup were all things that the decadents celebrated, but natural women are not just despised, but there's a sort of horror that surrounds natural women. I don't know if I can think of a decadent novel where that duality isn't present.
Another thing I found myself wondering when you kind of alluded to the virginity, and I was thinking about Freud's kind of going back and forth about whether, like, didn't he say early in his career that he thought all hysterics had been sexually molested in some way, and then later said, no, I think that was symbolic. I don't think it was literal. Even in the early trying to grapple with it, this element of sexuality, and certainly having read Dora, Portrait of a Hysteric, the Freud book in college, I remember being really shocked by Freud's interpretation, you know, when her father's colleague tries to kiss her, and because she's not aroused, there's something pathological in her. And I was outraged by this, you know. But I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that and how the changing ideas about that relationship played out.
Well, I think, you know, Freud, again, has really, it's right to criticize Freud. I just want to say that at the outset. You know, he had something, he called it the seduction theory. And it was because so many of the patients he was seeing were talking about childhood sexual abuse. And initially, he didn't really question it and came up with this sort of idea of a seduction theory. And then as one of the causes of hysteria. But later on, I think what was happening is that it was so common that he had a moment of being like, wait a minute, this cannot be true, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, he did then have this idea that psychic reality is just as important. And that's what I think we have to preserve. So we should criticize him for not believing his patients, that they were telling the truth.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I think it's important not to throw out everything else, because this idea that psychic reality, that there's a reality to psychic phenomena, is important to validate as well. And that's sort of what he did there. He didn't fully say that they're lying and therefore their trauma isn't real.
But it was like a symbolic memory of some sort. It just wasn't literal, but it was real. Yeah, which I think is something that we still see in, like, Jung talks about that too. You know, it can be just as real if it's not capital R real, but experienced as real.
And
you know?
Even Charcot, again, there was no sort of unconscious. He did talk about psychic trauma. And he would say, for example, that somebody falls off a horse and severs their spinal cord and they're paralyzed. And then another person falls off a horse, in his case, a female patient, and she's paralyzed, but without any damage to her spinal cord. And he acknowledges that that psychic trauma, the idea of the paralysis, can create a real paralysis. And again, it was a genuine paralysis, no feeling whatsoever in her legs that were, it was proved by, you know, sticking needles through, right through the leg, right? From one side to the other without her responding. So those, they were symptoms that would have been impossible to fake. So she had a genuine paralysis, but with no damage.
It's so fascinating. And when you started researching hysteria, you thought there was an answer and you just figured it out from reading all the literature. But really what you ended up is coming up against something that was resistant to our categories of thinking about the world, this kind of moment in history that is really, really hard to wrap our heads around and apply our own thinking boxes to, right?
Yes, 100%. And so in a way for me, no matter what I'm working on, I always end up back at in hysteria. I often find myself sort of laughing, like, okay, here I am again. And I think it's because it provides a kind of model of all the inexplicable things, the things that we want that we want to just say, you know, they don't exist, or they're imaginary, or we relegate them to something that is not real. Yeah, hysteria troubles that in a really interesting way. So
yeah, in a way that continues to be fascinating. To that end, I know that your investigation into hysteria led you into the territory that you're now doing research into. And I would love to hear you talk about how hysteria led to mediumship and what you're thinking about now and where you're going with these ideas.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I did not understand it initially. So I was fascinated by this, and I basically followed a doctor. Actually, there were several doctors who then became what was at the time called psychical researchers, which today I guess we'd call it paranormal researchers. And the late 19th century was not just the heyday of materialism or physicalism or positivism, whatever you want to call it. But it was also the heyday of spiritualism, which is, you know, the religion of communicating with the dead, and all sorts of esoteric occult groups cropped up, you know, all sorts of revivals of Rosicrucianism and Satanism and all kinds of things. The decadence, of course, cropped up as a response to materialism. So I was aware of that. And then there was one doctor, his name was Charles Richet, and he then became a very serious psychical researcher. And he also won the Nobel Prize in Physiology. He was not a, you know, he was a serious scientist. And I sort of followed him into the world of sort of mediumship. So he investigated many mediums very seriously. It's more in hindsight that I've understood how deeply connected they are. So I had been researching for some time various mediums, Ava Carrière, a woman named Leonie, and now I'm really focused on Eusebio Palladino. And I did not realize at the time, but it was only through further research that I discovered that they were all diagnosed as hysterics. So they were
amazing.
In fact, many at the time argued that mediumship was one of the many symptoms of hysteria. But I didn't know it when I first started this, and now I've gone. And in a way, it makes sense, because even Charcot, who really was a positivist, he did not believe in the supernatural. He never uses the word supernatural. But over and over again, he did experiments with his hysterical patients in which they displayed what can only be called supernatural abilities. He just pathologized it. He said that these are symptoms, but they could see through walls. They could predict the future. They could do, you know, incredible physical feats that defied physiology. In fact, he would often say that hysteria is a disease that defies anatomy. And so I often think about that. When you have a body that defies anatomy, you really are capable of all sorts of things. And he conducted all these experiments that really illustrated that they were indeed capable of defined anatomy. So
it's just amazing. And I think too, just about this fear of the female body, this imperfect female body, and these accusations of permeability, you know, being one of those things, and this idea of being a medium. So for those listeners who might not be familiar with what a medium does, could you talk a little bit about like what did they do, these mediums?
Well, mediums were the people who were able to communicate with the dead. But in the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, was when religion of spiritualism arose, and it was started, you know, famously in upstate New York to young girls, and young, 11 and 13, or maybe 12 and 14, the ages change a bit. The Fox sisters began communicating with a dead peddler who had been murdered in their basement. And this all came out after the fact. But somehow this launched this, it spread like wildfire. There were millions of followers in the United States. And I think at one point it said it was like close to 20% of the population, and it spread throughout Europe. It caught on, and I think people were hungry for this. And for many, it never went beyond kind of a parlor game, you know, that you'd sit in your living room and conduct seances. So, and then the medium was mostly women. I mean, the vast majority were women. The vast majority today still are women. And they were the ones that were able to communicate with the dead. That's what a medium is. And I guess all mediums are psychics. It's the rare psychic that is a medium. So that's the kind of that's the arrangement there.
And I think if I recall correctly, you are starting to investigate a particular medium, a particularly interesting one. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about her and what drew you to her of all of the other mediums.
Well, her name is Eusapia Palladino, and she was probably the most famous medium of her day. And she was born in 1854 and kind of came to prominence in the late 19th century, early 20th century. In my research, I kept coming across her, and she was always being referred to, but she was for many just dismissed as a charlatan because she did a lot of cheating. She was kind of a physical medium, which is basically the mediums who create physical phenomena, whether it's like an actual manifestation of a ghost or they, you know, table levitations. She was known to levitate herself. You know, she just like rise up in the air. And because of the cheating, I sort of thought, I don't think I want to, I have to deal with her, but I don't really want to deal with her. And finally, I came to the point in my research where I had to delve into it. And I basically changed the book I'm working on to focus on her because she's so incredibly fascinating. And she was investigated by 8 Nobel laureates. And they all acknowledged that they witnessed phenomena, you know, supernatural phenomena or paranormal phenomena, whatever you want to call it. And they didn't all come to believe in that it was ghosts, and it was wild things. You know, it was tables wouldn't just levitate, but they would thrash around the room. Her seances were often violent. Invisible hands would come and like slap and shake and punch. People left, you know, with gashes and Jesus. Bleeding, you know, it's like bar brawls, furniture flying all over the place. And these were not just gullible spiritualists who were conducting these seances. It was, you know, Madame Curie, Pierre Curie, Sir Oliver Lodge. He's the guy who discovered electromagnetic radiation. They were Nobel-winning scientists, physicists. And they were really trying to grapple with what does this mean, you know. And it was a moment in history where all sorts of invisible, powerful forces had been discovered. And I think they really thought that somehow this was yet another, you know, ray, force, wave that these women had been able to harness somehow or tap into. So they took it very seriously. And I think biographers of these scientists often want to dismiss their interest as just like, oh, a mere eccentricity. If they mention it at all, it's just this, it's like some silly little thing, you know, they like to wear pink pajamas or whatever. It's said in the same kind of tone. And the truth is that they're completely wrong because they took it incredibly seriously, and they really investigated this in the same way that they investigated whatever they won the Nobel Prize for. So she's fascinating.
And yeah, which how you're talking about it, you know, they were interested in, it seems to me, as a way to understand human consciousness and the capabilities of human consciousness, right? At a time when maybe more people had more open minds about what that might entail. It seems like to me, I don't know.
Yes, I think so. You know, Charcot, again, going back to hysteria and Charcot, he was one of the first people to come up that kind of thought of the brain rather as this sort of one blob or one organ. He was one of the people who came up with the idea of the different lobes had different functions.
Oh, wow.
And so already, you know, brain science was advancing. Many of the pioneers of psychology were also psychical researchers, and they worked with, again, hysterics and mediums and became very interested in what this was. So there were those, and scientists included, that, you know, it's sort of an inside-outside question. Is this phenomena being generated from the outside, which was sort of the spiritualist answer? In Eusapia Palladino's case, she had a spirit guide who was the ghost of a pirate, John King, who was actually a very busy ghost. He was many mediums' spirit guide. And there were people who believed that it was John King who was creating this phenomena. Therefore, the kind of the violence, and it was his hand that you felt punching you or hitting you or stroking you or whatever he was doing. But then there were those who insisted that that John King was actually part of Eusapia's unconscious, right? So that he was somehow a split off part of her personality. This was also the moment where multiple personality was first being described as a psychological condition. But of course, they still end up, if let's say he was part of her unconscious personality, they still have a hard time, like, how was she able to externalize this? Yeah. And then there were those who actually argued that ectoplasm, which is, you know, the kind of the gauzy goo that some mediums would emit, was an externalization of hysteria. So they struggled with that. I fully accept the reality of an unconscious personality. That's where I am. But I don't quite understand, then how is that unconscious personality
slapping people around?
That not just everybody in the room can see, you know? So how does she do that? And again, these were rooms that she often had never set foot in before. They were scientific laboratories. Sometimes there were other people's living rooms, whatever. But when it was in the context of scientific studies, they were rooms that were searched. There was no way that even if she was an extraordinary magician like a stage magician, there's no way that she would be able to do what she did. You know, even though she would cheat she'd always start her sessions, like these scientific seances, by saying, you know, now watch me carefully because I cheat. And she did cheat. She cheated all the time. But most of the time, the cheating was very obvious. People saw it. And then there were plenty of people who said, well, once she cheated, then it's all fake. And I think the people who hung in there were like, wait a minute. No, yes, we caught her cheating, but that doesn't mean that piece of furniture way across the room, or, I mean, they came up with all sorts of ways to try to prevent the cheating and to authenticate what it was that they had, what they were doing. So,
yeah. And I love that. I love that she talked about her own cheating, warned people to avoid it, and still was this great enigma. And I feel like I love that you find these historical female gendered enigmas and really give them their due, you know, with your, again, your mixture of real rigorous scholarship, but openness and not trying to fit it into a category. And I think that's really beautiful and really interesting. You recently wrote a really fascinating piece about the relationship between the mysteries of writing and reading. And I wonder if you could just say a few words about that, because I think that really has something to do with what we're talking about as well.
Yeah. So what happened when my very beloved brother-in-law died, and he was the novelist Paul Auster, and we were very close. And when... when he died, I started really thinking about reading and writing and what happens when we read, a kind of phenomenology of reading, if you will. It's really quite strange. And I think everybody sort of knows that reading is, you know, a cognitive act of decoding signs. But I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about how when you pick up any book and kind of get lost in that book, and it's mostly fiction, but not always, but mostly fiction. And like, who's reading to whom? And whose consciousness, is it your own consciousness? Is it the author's consciousness? And where do you go? And what or who takes your place? So it seems to me like a form of sort of possession, often a kind of form of necromancy. It's a way of reviving the dead. And it's something that's so banal because we do it all the time and usually don't think about it in those terms. But I mean, people often think, you know, that we use all these expressions, you know, like an author brings characters to life, you know, and then I start thinking about the object of a book and how a book is kind of a dead object, you know, when it's sitting there. But once you open it up and you start reading it, the object sort of disappears, its materiality disappears, and something else comes to life. And I think most of us talk about how, you know, Shakespeare is still alive today when you read, you know. So I think we all are sort of familiar with this, but when you delve into it a bit, it's really strange.
It's so invisible because it's part of our everyday life, but I think I absolutely agree. I think there's something really interesting to chew on there and wonder about.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So yeah, so I'm still kind of working on that. And again, it's a sort of uncomfortable place for me to be because I'm so, what I like doing and what I often have done is, you know, and it's often gendered, it's often women and how their bodies become the site where different epistemologies kind of collide and do battle and they resist it. And this is not that. This is really becomes personal in a different way. So I'm a little bit, I feel still a little uncomfortable with it, but I think that there is something there. So.
Yeah. And I personally think being uncomfortable is a good sign in your creative work.
I'm sure.
My two cents.
And I tend to stick to what I feel like really comfortable with. And
I get that too.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to end. I have a series of three questions that I'm asking each guest to kind of anchor these talks. And the first one is, looking back on your career as a writer, as a thinker, do you think there's a way in which the idea of death has been animating your work and your life and or your life?
Well, I would say sort of not explicitly, but I do think that, you know, death is often sort of the great, or at least after death, you know, the afterlife is thought of as this sort of great unknown. And clearly, you know, my focus now on mediums, it's all about communicating with the dead or with the kind of consciousness that survives after our bodies die. So there's that. But I think I'd say that in some ways, because I'm an independent scholar, once I met you and found Morbid Anatomy, it provided a kind of an institution, if you, you know, and I don't want to call you an institution because negative connotation, but it provided me with the sort of organization and institution that I was missing. And I think that my work has definitely been influenced by many of the lectures and work and that is being done in that community. So yeah, so that's what I would say.
Well, I think that's a great answer. My next question is, if you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
Oh boy. I don't know. I don't think I would want to live forever. And that's where my gut is, what my gut is saying. You know, I think there's probably all sorts of science fiction novels about just that and the horrors of what that would mean. So yeah, I would say no.
Okay, I'm with you. But I'm always curious. Some people, I meet people who do, so I'm curious.
There's that whole, I probably shouldn't be critical because I think I don't know enough about it, but there is the whole sort of tech bro sphere of life. And again, it's often sort of misogynist because it's a form of life that wants to bypass the female body in order to sustain it. And in order to kind of, you know, the fantasy of the singularity and AI giving, you know, creating a way to bypass women. And no, so that I've gone from like a hesitant no to an emphatic
to a horrified no.
Yes.
With you. And finally, has your work changed the way you think about death and or what happens after?
Yes.
In any way? Yes?
Oh, 100%. 100%. So I think that for a long time, I'm not a religious person. I've never been a religious person. I was raised sort of a Lutheran, which is basically about as non-religious as you can get within a framework of religion, right? So very stripped down, very spare. So I think I was always fully sort of accepted a kind of materialist model unquestioningly. And at this point, I'm very far from that position. I'm in a very sort of murky, epistemologically murky space, and I'm very happy to be there. And I feel like it's really the hysterics and female mediums. And I've been reading a lot of William James, who I just love, and he's been really deeply influential in articulating for me many of the theoretical issues that I've been and trying to deal with.
All right, great. And finally, where can our listeners find out more about your work?
I do not have a website. I've been trying to think about doing a website for now, probably going on a couple decades. And at one point I started and then stopped, and I do not. But I should do that. I know I should do that.
Well, you can look up her name on the internet and you'll be directed to her many books. You can also check out the Morbid Anatomy Patreon, where we've archived a bunch of her wonderful lectures. And we didn't even talk about your lecture style, which is a mix, again, of rigor, openness, but also humor, I would say, like a warm, respectful humor. And just the information, the stories you uncover, and by giving full space to all of the aspects, become absurd, fascinating, challenging, and totally engaging. So, Aasi, thank you so much for being here and for your brilliant work and for being part of the Morbid Anatomy community.
Thank you, Joanna. Yes.
After each interview, my producer Jess and I like to discuss what we talked about and see what our thoughts are. So I'm going to bring this to you first, Jess, as I think I always do at this point, because I'm very familiar with Aasi and her work. I wonder how you felt about it.
Well, I learned so much. I didn't know a lot of that. I'm obviously familiar with the phrasing of being decadent, but I had no idea about the
movement.
The movement. No, oh, yeah. I hadn't realized that at all. So that was
that book is incredible. That yeah. I have it. I believe I have it on the bookshelf in your guest room right now.
Oh, great. Yeah. I'll have a look through it.
Yeah.
But that was fascinating. And the talk about the woman's body and the way that she was saying they kind of thought that the uterus was roaming around the body causing havoc. I do feel like that at times. that might be happening. And I also hadn't realized. So in my mind, hysteria was connected to the womb and was a thing that people thought in oldie timeies that, you know, when a woman was mentally ill or something, they blamed it on hysteria, i.e. the womb. I hadn't realized all the wider kind of meaning and thinking around it. And that Anasti was saying that she believes it still exists in some ways. It's the disease of symptoms that you can't find diagnosis for. What do you think about that?
I think it's super interesting. In her book, I mean, she wrote the book a long time ago, but she talks about like chronic fatigue, things like chronic fatigue.
Oh, ME.
Things that are still diagnosed that I think also don't have any identifiable organic causes, but create very real symptoms, right? And are mostly diagnosed on women.
Yeah, completely fascinating. And when we kind of moved into talking about mediums, and she was speaking about the medium that had a spirit guide that was the ghost of a pirate, that was immense.
and beat people up during the sessions. Yeah.
Yeah, that was incredible. I love those stories. Who would your spirit guide be, do you think?
Oh, God, I have no idea.
No. And then when you kind of were talking about the mysteries of writing and reading together, and she described writing as a form of possession, that resonated. Like, yeah, that kind of fixation of when you're locked in, you're writing. Do you feel, is that something that you kind of connect with?
Well, definitely the aspects of being lifted out of yourself and being in a totally different place that was not your place and not from your psyche, not from your intellect. Absolutely, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, she wrote a really beautiful obituary about Paul Auster, who is her brother-in-law. Mm. She was talking about, we republished it on our Patreon, actually, so people can read it and they can search it.
Mm.
Where she talks a lot about this idea. And I think, yes, I think it's, as she said, it's something prosaic that we do every day. And so it tends not to be something we think about in a serious way. But I do think there's a mystery there for sure.
Mm. Yeah, it's really not something I'd considered. So it's a really interesting idea. And then finally, when you were kind of doing your quickfire questions and the live forever, I like that she had to pause for a moment. You know, quite a lot of the others have been straight no, but she, you know, Asti gave it a good thought. But she's now the second person to mention this kind of movement at the moment of these kind of tech
transhumanism,
bros,
yeah,
that are wanting to live forever. Brian Johnson. So his documentary is called "Don't Die: The Man That Wants to Live Forever."
Mm.
And I saw him on an episode of The Kardashians as well, because I'm highbrow. I'm here to lower the tone. I wonder what a conversation with him would be like about death.
I don't think he'd see much positivity in it.
No.
Or possibility for transformation or regeneration. But then if you're super rich and white and healthy, maybe you don't want to be transformed.
For
maybe
sure.
You want to have exactly the life you have for a long, long time, if not forever.
Absolutely. That also makes me think about a theme that's come up through some of these conversations is that returning to the earth, you know, becoming part of it again and it being our turn to go back and to let other things grow. And there does seem to be a lack of that in that kind of contemporary search for living forever.
I think for the people that are trying to develop this technology, they have literally every other thing, right?
Mm.
So this is like the final frontier of never giving up any of those things. And think of the repercussions of that. The others on Earth, like what if billionaires did live forever? Oh my God, the rest of us would be completely screwed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com. Momentum Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.